You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert. And the very first time that this country started turning away immigrants at its ports and borders, it was a lot like today. There had been a wave of people coming here from abroad for work. There was a lot of anxiety about them competing with the Americans who were already here for jobs and for business. There was mob violence against the new immigrants. But the first time Congress acted to block a whole category of immigrants based on where they were coming from, it was not Mexicans, and it was not Muslims. It was people from China.
We have to remember that in the 19th century, immigration into the United States was basically open. You just showed up. So the Chinese exclusion law is really the first and only time in the entire history of the United States that a group is singled out by name, Chinese, by name, as being undesirable.
That is the story that our next two guests set out to tell with a new feature-length documentary that is currently airing on PBS entitled The Chinese Exclusion Act. Lixin Yu and Rick Burns are the film's co-directors. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much for having us.
So you both started working on this project before Donald Trump started his run at the presidency. What were you setting to do out?
Well, 2012, the New York Historical Society came to us. They were doing a exhibition on the Chinese Exclusion Act and wanted to know if we wanted to join them in doing a companion documentary. And we just kind of jumped on it. It was not a history that either one of us knew very much about. We had done the film about the winning and losing of the West, in which during the course of that we had come upon a violent incident against Chinese miners. And we're really surprised that we knew nothing about it. And as, you know, over time, as we learned more, it was not only is the violence of the incident shocking, but it was shocking because it was happening all across the West, you know. And it was further shocking to find out that it was the acts of violence were committed after the passage of the Chinese Exclusion Act, which, you know, one would think, well, an act is passed that should appease whatever ill feelings people might have, but in fact, it actually generated more violence.
I mean, you know, the incident Lucian's referring to, 1887, 30-odd mutilated, dismembered bodies of Chinese miners float to the surface of the Snake River and float by Lewiston, 65 miles south of where they were massacred. And I think what's kind of uncanny is that this history, the Chinese Exclusion Act, passed into law, signed into law by Chester A. Arthur on May 6, 1882, sort of like kind of floated to the surface of our minds, you know, only 5 or 6 years ago. And the question was like, why don't we know this history? This is not an incidental, sort of kind of out of the way peripheral aspect of American history. This is immigration. This is who gets to come here, who gets to decide who gets to come here and when. And that's a very, very central aspect of the American experience. And to realize that we really don't know anything about the kind of DNA of that, that experience, that we've, you know, we're a nation of immigrants. We have come to like to think that we're happy with that, but that this crucial understanding of when we first became a gatekeeping nation and how that came about and in relationship to what population just got submerged, just sank to the bottom of the of our collective memory.
So where you kind of start the backlash narrative is in the Sierra Mountains in California towards the end of the Gold Rush. What's going on then?
I mean, one thing that's important is to understand that this history is really deeply situated in the entirety of American history. Long before there were Chinese here, we had a trade with China. In fact, was the reason why we floated ourselves out of bankruptcy after the Revolutionary War. And the Chinese didn't appear for the Gold Rush out of nowhere. They appeared out of South China after decades of colonial depredation, which had really ruined the political and economic infrastructure of South China, and meant that when gold was discovered in 1849, January 1848, in Sutter's Creek in California, in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada, the world rushed in, and therefore Chinese, who had all sorts of push factors at home to do so, rushed in with them. And so there you have at this very beginning moment of the American West, you know, California has become a brand new state in 1850. The first Chinese are coming in at exactly that time with the rest of the 49ers. And for the first time in American history, you have an Anglo population having to deal with, other than Native Americans and African Americans, new populations from abroad, having to deal with the reality of being inescapably part of a global culture. And as so many things in American history have been experimented in California, so this crucial piece of the American experience was experimented with in California. And what was decided very quickly in California was that California should belong to white Americans, full stop, although it, of course, had belonged to Californios, Mexican Americans, Native Americans, Spanish Americans for a very long time before that. Now this suddenly new American territory was being defined as a place for white Americans. And when the Chinese showed up, they were turned upon with a tremendous virulence. And that's where the rhetoric, the idea that this is a foreign and unassimilable population of not quite human beings who have a different culture, a different biology, and are so foreign, so geared to despotism, servile in nature, prone to sort of acting in enslaved ways, that they couldn't possibly be part of the American experiment and therefore needed to be kept out. So they were kind of a national security threat in that respect from the beginning in California. And at the same time, were ginned up as some group which was somehow, quote, stealing the jobs or the gold that rightfully belonged to white American miners. That gestalt, the phony threat of national security, the phony labor problem, the rhetoric of difference and unassimilability is exactly the gestalt we deal with today. So that moment is key, because that's where in the early 1850s, for the first time in American history, this particular attitude towards immigrants who are other, who need to be kept out, was formulated. And it's crucial in that context to remember that when you got to America in 1850, whether you were on the East Coast or the West Coast, there was no border, there was no regulation, there was no immigration service, you had no passport, you got off the boat and kind of melted into the American background. So this is really happening at a moment where there were no laws that were determining who could and couldn't come at this moment. This is where we began to invent them.
Right. So I think you've described the attitudes towards Chinese immigrants. What I'm trying to get at is kind of the material conditions behind those attitudes, because California at the time is getting immigrants from all over. It's getting aspiring miners from Chile, from the mining regions of Mexico. Japanese people are coming into the area. In fact, in terms of transit time, California is closer to all those places than it is to the eastern seaboard of the United States, because there's no Continental Railroad yet. And it's not that those other groups didn't experience racism, but the Chinese in particular are singled out to be controlled through immigration law. What's different about them?
I think Chinese were just defined as so the other. You know, they dress differently. The men have long hair. Their clothing are flowing. They eat strange food with strange instrument. And it just became an easy political tool.
And they have different colored skin.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, that's brought up right away. Norman Ossing, who was a Chinese immigrant to California and very quickly became one of the leaders of the burgeoning Chinese community in San Francisco by the early 1850s, in a stunningly eloquent rebuke to Governor John Bigler's attempt to exclude the Chinese from California early in the 1850s, you know, pointed out, you know, very ironically, first of all, that these laws being proposed in California in the event unsuccessfully in the 1850s to keep out the Chinese were un-American, that as he put it, all of American history, all of our laws, all of our experience, all of our ideals go against this idea of exclusion. And then he said it ironically at the end of his remarks published in the Daily Alta California in 1852, and Governor Bigler, please be aware, we are fully aware that our complexion is a little more tan than yours. So I think that what you're seeing is in an American circumstance in which the issue of race, skin color, is, you know, let's say on fire in the 1850s. This is the decade in which the Civil War became inevitable. That all sorts of ideas of the privileges of whiteness the wages of whiteness, as W.E.B. Du Bois would put it in the next century, in which you have conferred on you a special status, which is kind of almost the coin of the realm. You can trade in it. You can count on certain kinds of status possibilities if you're white, is being invoked right there at the beginning of the state of California as something important to make sure you understand there's really two kinds of people. There are people who are white and deserving, and there are people who are not quite white and maybe even black, or certainly a little tanner than the whites, who have to be understood as being less deserving and quite possibly, in the case of the Chinese, people who are going to define otherness. I mean, think about there are the Sonorans, there are the Mexicans, there are the French, there are the Russians, there are the Americans, there are the Chinese, all mixing it up with Californios, as you were saying, in early American California. This is going to be a place where identity is up for grabs in an extremely urgent way. So it's precisely at that moment that America begins to look really powerful, Americans, white Americans, to an idea of whiteness to determine what basically constitutes default, pure, plausible Americans. This is the moment where that's happening, and it's happening because a burgeoning heterogeneity on the ground is now making questions of identity within the American sphere really, really urgent, really, really tense.
So the kind of next economic twist is the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad. It had relied on the labor of thousands of Chinese immigrants. They find themselves abruptly unemployed when that project comes to fruition. Where do they go? What happens to them?
Well, many of them spread throughout the West or back to the coast along to Chinatown. And Chinatowns were formed simply because, you know, it was a safe place for Chinese to be. You know, the violence against them, besides, they weren't allowed to live anywhere else, and the livelihood was only possible there.
You know, the Chinese famously become the workforce par excellence for the Central Pacific Railroad's end, because there simply wasn't a labor supply in Northern California to equal the largely Irish American immigrants coming from the East building the Union Pacific. And when this unemployed population goes back, suddenly they are now confronting the reality that it's a very complex and interesting reality. The nation is now joined by a ribbon of steel. That means that the West and the East are connected. All the economic possibilities and issues of both sides of the country now go rocketing towards each other. So the country becomes very much smaller, really, when that golden spike gets hammered in July of 1869. And the economic issues that have been affecting the West now go east. The economic issues of the East, soon the depression of the 1870s is going to flood west to California in ways it could never have. And at the same time, all those issues that have to do with the labor situation and the definition of otherness in California now become nationalized across the American entire American continent. And what's crucial about it as well is that, remember, the railroad's being built to create a faster way to get to China. Basically, that's been the American mantra since, you know, Columbus. We're trying to get to the Orient fast. We want to get our hands on the China trade. And so this infrastructural miracle called the Iron Road to China by many people at the time had been built, Lincoln called it into being, in order to increase and augment the China trade, because that was so important to the national treasury. At that very moment, as things are going to be moving more and more rapidly, not only because of the railroad, but because of signature treaties like the Burlingame Treaty of 1868, which have guaranteed the free flow of people and things between China and America in both directions. At the same time, this issue, what are we going to do with this population, which has already been prepackaged in the 1850s and early 1860s in California, the Chinese, as a yellow peril, a massive horde. They're going to come and steal your jobs, and they also are an unassimilable population who basically define what the meaning of un-American is. Now, of course, those are a set of fact-free assertions. They're, in fact, just like Irish-American immigrants, Chinese-American immigrants. They may have slightly different cosmetic features, but the fact of the matter is that as people, they're no different at all. So you see this other crucial piece of the exclusion puzzle, another piece that we use today, which is it's entirely fact-free. All the facts are made up. There is no labor competition that's meaningful. And by the way, if a Chinese person gets a job and an Irish person doesn't get a job, what's wrong with that? I mean, you know, if an Irish person gets a job and a Chinese person doesn't get a job, why is that a good thing? So suddenly one realizes that one is confronting starkly the realities of racism, that there shouldn't simply, these invidious distinctions shouldn't be being made, but nevertheless, they're being made, and they're being made to seem inevitable and being made to be the basis of what's now a national sort of symptomatology of what doesn't work into your culture and what does work into your culture. And then it becomes, you know, once the lie's in print, it goes national and becomes unavoidable. And therefore, you know, hence 1882, for 61 years, these laws are on the books.
Yeah. And you know, in the 70s, the political imagination was because of the collapse of Reconstruction. So here we are, you know, essentially triangulating race issues, pitting one against the other and vying for votes. You know, those elections of 1876 was very close. It was one electoral vote. And so, you know, the political pandering just became really a forceful issue that got this law passed.
So the documentary is not just a story about what was inflicted upon the Chinese, but a story of what they did for themselves in the face of that racism and that institutionalized and legalized discrimination. The Chinese community here in the United States proves to be very articulate advocates for their own rights, particularly adroit at navigating the legal barriers that have been erected to keep people from coming into the country. Could you tell us the story of Wong Kim Ark?
Right. It's an incredibly inspiring story. Here, Wong Kim Ark, born in San Francisco, 1871. And, you know, as because of exclusion, Chinese families are separated. So Chinese here often need to go back to China to visit family. And Wong Kim Ark has done so with his parents a number of times. And then in 1890, I forget the date now, he comes back and was refused entry by a staunch anti-Chinese exclusionist. And so Wong Kim Ark goes, you know, this is un-American. This is not right. I have every right to be here. And so he, you know, with the Chinese community supporting him, fought it all the way to the Supreme Court. Based on the 14th Amendment, birthright citizenship was then solidly placed into our law.
I mean, here's another one of these pieces that floated somehow to the bottom of the American collective consciousness. I would have said, and I would have been wrong, 10 years ago, if I were asked, where did birthright citizenship come from? The idea that if you're born here, that makes you an American. I mean, that's just the stuff that Americans just, we breathe that. We assume that. It's like water. I would have thought, I don't know. Is it in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights? I'll have to go back and check. Maybe it's something that Alexander Hamilton and James Madison talked about. Maybe it's a Federalist idea. No. Up it comes in the 1890s in this very specific court case brought by Wong Kim Ark, who's simply saying, listen, I was born here. I'm not going to be denied citizenship. And this sort of incredibly, what's incredibly moving is the shrewdness with which the Chinese community, who remember can't vote, they can't become citizens. Those who are here, the Exclusion Act not only said if you aren't already here and you're Chinese, you can't come. It did say that those who were here could stay, but they can't become citizens. So they can't vote. They have extremely marginal political status within this. So what tools do they have? They have the law. They can, and they file an enormous number of legal suits between 1882 and 1905. The figure is something like 9,000 or 10,000, which turns out to be 8 to 9% of the Chinese who are here went to court to fight this, of which Wong Kim Ark is the most spectacular and the one that really sort of stands for them all in a certain way. And this incredibly important, you know, a few dozen words in, you know, the citizenship clause of the 14th Amendment, you know, one of the three Civil War amendments passed in 1868. Meant to overturn Dred Scott, which had said black people have no rights in this country that a white person need respect. That language said, listen, equal protection under the law means all persons, not just all people who happen to be already American citizens, all persons get equal protection under the law. And then in the interpretation that the Supreme Court provided in Wong Kim Ark in 1898, they said, well, what that means is you may not like it, but Wong Kim Ark is a person, and therefore he is going to be equally protected by this citizenship clause. Therefore, he is a citizen. They didn't do it because they liked Chinese. They did it because, you know, millions of people from Europe were coming in at the same time. And if you kind of destabilize the way in which you understood what the child of an immigrant was in 1898 by saying, well, they weren't automatically citizens, if they happened to be born here, you would be creating this administrative nightmare from which the American Union would never recover at the turn of the 20th century. So they said, listen, everybody who's born here is an American citizen. So, you know, one wants to say, hand on one's heart, here is an American, Wong Kim Ark, who taught the rest of America. I was born in Baltimore in 1955, therefore I know I'm an American. If you were born somewhere in America and you thereby know you are an American, I want you to take your hat off to Wong Kim Ark and say thank you for defining so central an aspect of the American experience. That should come out of this experience of exclusion. The Wong Kim Ark and his family were Americans before the letter, a long time before, because they brought a set of ideals, they doubled down on American ideals, and they in fact left a footprint a mile wide and a mile deep, which all Americans follow, whether they know or not. So on the positive side, as well as on the shocking side, this story leaves an important, important trace for all Americans, because it shows so much about central aspects of our experience.
Rick Burns, Li Xinyu, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Brian. It's been wonderful talking with you.
Li Xinyu and Rick Burns are co-directors of the new documentary, The Chinese Exclusion Act. It's currently airing on PBS, also streaming for free for a couple more days on the American Experience website. That link will close on June 25th.